The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Yes, it is, and welcome back. Monday, August 7th, 2019, as we're heading into our second hour, our penultimate hour of the day. It is a delight to welcome back our good friend David Riaboy. He is with, as he is the vice president of the Security Studies Group. He is also our in-house. In-house is the wrong word, but I can't say the opposite, David. I was going to say in-house jazz expert. You're not our outhouse jazz expert. But shall we say external studies director of jazz? How's that?
Sure. Adjunct fellow.
Exactly. Yeah. I want to get to your jazz selection of the week in a little bit, as we will do. Sure. But a lot of talk right now, obviously, about Donald Trump, President Trump's decision to withdraw troops from Syria. How should we think about it? How should we think about the controversy? What are your thoughts?
So we're about 3 years into this presidency at this point, and it seems like even we, who are largely supportive of the president and are aware of, sort of hyper aware of the media's bias and fake news and the whole thing, we even get played sometimes too. So I know that many of us like to have at least a 24-hour rule before we kind of go crazy and set our hair on fire based on what the media says. And this is one of those stories. So late last night, on a Sunday night, it came out that the White House said, "Hey, we're going to move out of the way, and the Turks are insistent on coming into coming into Syria to go after, frankly, to go after Kurdish terrorists who are threatening them and that border area between Syria and Turkey, We're going to allow them to do this." And the media and the Democrats and many neighbor Trumpers just exploded, and they said, "Oh my God, this is Trump inviting Erdogan and Turkey to commit a genocide against our allies, the Kurds." Well, the truth is a little more complicated than that. So it's come out today, this afternoon, that the United States has suspended all cooperation with the Turkish military in terms of that border region. There was an agreement that they hammered out as recently as a couple days ago. They were going on joint mission in this region. And basically, the president said to Erdogan, "Look, either you stay with us and you cooperate and you have the benefit of U.S. military cooperation and on our good side, or you move into Syria and we're done with you." And Erdogan, this is what I've heard from sources in the White House, Erdogan flipped out, overreacted, and said, "We're going." So I think the president correctly realized that we don't have a whole lot of leverage here in terms of stopping the Turks. What we're going to do is we're going to give them the ball. We're not going to allow them to massacre, Kurds wholesale in Syria, but they will be responsible, and it's going to heavily impact the relationship with Turkey going forward. So I don't think it's a calamity. I think we're finally getting policymakers to admit to themselves that there was always going to be a conflict between Turkey and the Kurds. And there was never any scenario wherein we would favor the Kurds when push came to shove. That's not a popular thing to say. I wish it wasn't that way, because frankly, in many ways, I prefer the Kurds to the Turks, but the Kurds don't have a state in Syria. If we want to give them a state, we can give them a state in Iraq. But in the conflict between the Turks and the Kurds, the Turks will always win. They're in NATO, and they have the resources. They're just a much more important country to us.
Now, that was a really good overview, David. Thank you for doing that. One of the things one hears is we're letting down one of our great allies, the Kurds, who have done so much for us. There are some problems with that statement in and of itself, are there not?
I think so. I think when people say the Kurds, they mean the Kurds they like,
right?
As opposed to the Kurdish Workers Party and you know, legit straight up terrorists who are operating in Turkey and out of Syria. You know, there's a difference between the Kurds that helped us fight ISIS in Iraq and helped us with Saddam and during the second Gulf War, and the guys who are inside Turkey and Syria right now.
Right. So it's first of all a different group altogether, right?
Right.
Right. Second of all, we have had a lot of problems with Turkey, but as you say, at the end of the day, they are still a NATO member. And then finally, there's this question about why are we in Syria in the first place? Now, a lot of us had our heartstrings obviously pulled by a lot of the massacre going on there at the hands of Assad. This is not that.
Right. No, I don't think it's that. Hopefully it will not be that. I think what we can do is we can work to establish an independent Kurdistan out of Iraq and say, hey, if you Kurds want to relocate and form an actual state in a geographic area that is not inside of Turkey or Syria, then great, let's have a go. But right now there are Kurds spread across Turkey, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and at some point they've got to all get together in a geographic area if they want some kind of self-determination.
Yeah, self-determination of their own state. Exactly,
yeah.
Right. Now, the numbers of withdrawal here, people might be under the assumption we're talking about thousands of troops. We're not talking about anything on that order, are we?
No. No, we're really not. I mean, I don't think necessarily we're losing anything by having troops there. I never thought that it was a great affront or a mistake to station that number of troops in we're talking what, under 1,000
maybe not 100, maybe not even 100 possibly.
Right. So it's, you know, I mean, look, if you're the United States and you're a great superpower and you have this military might, it's almost offensive putting 100 servicemen into a place like that without a clear mission, without a clear...
Well, we've been there before. We know how that usually doesn't end well.
Right, exactly. I think there's a temptation to say, the hell with the whole region,
mm-hmm.
and just walk away. And I certainly understand that temptation based on how poorly a lot of our elites have how poorly that they've performed their strategic tasks over the last 20 years. I understand that temptation greatly, but that said, if we're going to, as I probably said before on your show, if we're going to get out, then we need to empower our allies to take our place. And that should always be job one, is to figure out, okay, you know, if our national interest, if Syria is not in our national interest, but it's in the national interest of our allies in the region, then, you know, we want to do everything possible to help them short of, you know, short of military commitment.
We're going into.
Yeah,
go ahead.
So, you know, we certainly don't want to kneecap our allies for doing what they perceive to be in their strategic interest in the region if we don't have a dog in that fight.
We're going into a break, David. I was hoping if I can keep you for another segment, maybe talk a little bit with us about what I know some of the audience will say, which is, well, I thought Donald Trump was kind of elected in part to stop these foreign adventures in places that don't seem to have a lot to do with the United States. Can you talk with us a little bit about the new kind of foreign policy thinking Donald Trump has spoken about when we come back on the other side of this break a little bit?
Sure.
That and Sonny Clark, of course. We're talking to and we're talking with David Riebois. He is the Vice President for Strategic Operations, Senior Vice President for Strategic Operations at the Security Studies Group. SecurityStudies.org is the website. I'm Seth Leibson. He's David Riebois. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Those are the tunes and tones of Conrad Sonny Clark. David Riebois, our guest, is going to tell us a little bit about why he selected this album and Sonny Clark for us in just a few moments. But before we do that, David, I want to continue just for a few moments to take advantage of your other day job work. Your Senior Vice President for Strategic Operations at the Security Studies Group. Donald Trump was elected in part to kind of forge a new way of our foreign and military policy as it affects operations abroad. And it was kind of new talk from a Republican, the kind of talk you hadn't heard from a Republican in a long time. In some respects, the kind of talk you hadn't heard from a Democrat in a long time. And mostly it had the appeal, to put it crudely, if I might, of you know, not having our military operate any further or any longer or any more in places that really didn't have a direct interest to America. And I guess at this stage in the administration, 2.5 some odd months in, I'd ask, how's that going? And am I phrasing it about right? How do you see it?
I think that's largely true, but there's a key thing that's missing.
Okay.
So when there's a phrase that the president uses all the time, and a lot of people use it, and it's endless Middle East wars, or endless wars.
Right.
And when you say that, some people hear endless, and some people hear wars.
Oh, okay.
And I think, the emphasis is on one word or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think Donald Trump is not shy, and frankly, most of his voters were not shy about using the military when it's in our interest.
Yeah, we like the idea of smashing ISIS. We like that idea.
Right. We like the idea of smashing ISIS. We like the idea of if World War II, of maybe the first Gulf War. We don't have a problem with. We don't have a problem with fighting when we need to,
mm-hmm.
But the point that Trump tapped into during the campaign was the endless part.
Okay,
which is how is it that we are by far the most powerful nation, the most powerful military that the world has ever known, and we can't win in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
We can't win in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Then under Obama, we go in and we topple the government of Gaddafi militarily in Libya, which opens up a nasty Pandora's box where there eventually are slave markets and Islamists and all kinds of totally predictable nonsense.
Right.
On the other hand, too, Obama did the same thing diplomatically with Mubarak,
right.
and allowed him to be toppled at the same time, which is you know, frankly, just another way of doing the same thing, just not militarily. Mm-hmm. So I think the American people and especially Trump voters have gotten so weary of the you know, the elite foreign policy class and that consensus being in a complete bubble. And, you know, if you think a lot of the D.C. commentariat on foreign policy thinks that, you know, everything with Iraq was hunky-dory. Everything with Afghanistan is hunky-dory. We can be there forever. Not a problem, because nobody is, you know, nobody really there is suffering. You just write another white paper. Maybe you write a blog post. You go on TV and that's it. That's the only way it really affects you. And the American people kind of got sick of that. They got sick of the endless part. And as time goes on and we are unable to win these wars, it's inevitable that people look back and they say, why did we do this in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Is this getting us anywhere? Mm-hmm. Maybe there was a rationale at the beginning, but if you couldn't wrap this stuff up within a year or 2 years, then you really can't, you know, then the bottom falls out.
Sons should not be fighting in the same wars their fathers were in.
Right. No, I mean, it's really scandalous. And I remember, I always think about when John McCain said that, you know, this is a 100 years war or something. Well, it's like, okay, that's fine for you to say, but what happens in 5 years when the mists of time and memory and another generation and the change of the political environment, what have you, makes it so that the original cause of the war is like no longer known or understood or really even relevant.
Right. Right.
You know, actually it was Angelo Codavilla that kind of tipped me to this line of thinking years ago, which was that, you know, democracies by their very nature have to fight quick wars.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to maintain the support of the people.
That's right.
And we've gotten to the point where the military adventurism has just lost the support of the people.
Yeah.
And now I think we're in a really dangerous situation, because if we really do have to fight, that's you know, you've cried wolf so many times.
You don't have the consensus for when you need it. Exactly right.
Right, exactly. So that terrifies me, because yes, I know that there are absolutely threats out there that potentially we will face and we will have to face militarily. And, you know, I'm mad as hell at these guys for fouling it up to the point where if we really need to do something militarily, we just don't have the credibility to do so.
Thank you, David. Take a minute, as we have about a minute left, and tell us why you selected Sonny's Crib, which is a great, great sextet, including John Coltrane on sax. Tell us just a little bit about this.
Sure. So this is one of my favorite kind of this is one of my favorite records from 1958. And 1959 gets a lot of play, because there were so many classic records, Kind of Blue and Time Out and Mingus Ah-Um and Shape of Jazz to Come, Ornette Coleman, came out in 59. But 58 was a really remarkable year, too, because it was a huge year in Coltrane's development.
Mm-hmm.
And he was doing his Sheets of Sound thing, which you kind of have to hear in order to appreciate what that means. But I've always kind of gravitated towards records where there's maybe one player who seems like he is 10, 20, or 100 light years ahead of the rest of the band.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is definitely one of those records. And everybody is, you know, it's a crack, as you mentioned, it's such a crack band.
Yeah, Don Byrd.
Don Byrd.
Yeah, yeah.
And Paul Chambers,
yeah.
and Curtis Fuller, Sonny Clark writing a lot of the tunes and all the arrangements. But Coltrane just soars above it all, and every solo is a masterpiece.
Nice.
The ensemble playing is great, and it's a kind of classic Blue Note record from that period.
It's real jazz. Sonny's Crib is the album. David Riaboy selected for us today. David, Godspeed. We'll check in with you soon. Thanks for everything.
Absolutely. Have a good one.
Talk to you soon. If you're feeling run down, don't have the energy that you used to, it's probably because you're not eating enough fruits and vegetables. It's time to try Balance of Nature's fruits and vegetables in capsule form. Balance of Nature is not like ordinary vitamins that are made with synthetics. It's just natural food in a vegetarian capsule with tens of thousands of vital nutrients from 100% whole food, fruits, vegetables, and plants. A daily dose of Balance of Nature capsules has 10 servings of 31 different fruits and vegetables. Once you start taking Balance of Nature, you'll feel great. People report that their skin looks better and they have a lot more energy. It's time to improve the quality of your life. Experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself. Call or go online now and become a preferred customer, which gets you their best pricing and free shipping. And they'll take off an additional $25 from your first order. This is a limited time offer, so don't wait. Call 800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com and make sure to use discount code BALANCE. Interesting little study and story today in the Wall Street Journal. We've kind of talked about, around, and along these lines. And now we have social science, I guess, coming to show that the theoretical can be proved somewhat by the actual. Samathi Reddy, I think I say her name right, writes that an Iowa man is so bothered by the political climate that a psychologist says he asked for a higher dosage of his anxiety medication. A Chicago woman is so uneasy about politics that she has needed two dental implants to deal with her teeth grinding habit. And a New York woman says she suffered her first flare-up of multiple sclerosis in 10 years due to political angst. Americans are stressed, and politics is a major cause, according to psychologists and recent surveys. A study published in September in the journal PLOS-1 found that politics is a source of stress for 38% of Americans. The major takeaway from this is that if our numbers are really anywhere in the ballpark, there are tens of millions of Americans who see politics as exacting a toll on their social, psychological, emotional, and even physical health. So says Kevin Smith, lead author of one study and chair of the political science department at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. The study included 800 people in a nationally representative poll and asked them 32 questions. Among the findings, 11.5% say politics has adversely affected their physical health. 18.3% say they lost sleep because of politics. 26.4% say they become depressed when a preferred candidate lost. 26.5% say politics has led them to hate some people, and 20% say differences in views have damaged a valued friendship. Dr. Smith's note that the survey explored people's perceptions of their health, not actual diagnoses. The effects seem to be more pronounced for those who are younger, on the political left, and interested and engaged in politics. This is exactly what I could have told you. This is a survey about the young. This is me speaking. It's a survey about the young, and it's a survey about the left. In other words, it's a survey about one political side that doesn't know what losing looks like, and they're immature in their political understandings and in, frankly, all of their understandings of the world. One psychologist in Newton, Iowa, says she had a patient so distressed he wanted to abstain from politics altogether. He identified as an independent, and when he voiced this to several family members and friends, he got some backlash from them saying he needed to pick a side. This is a story of a patient about nothing. If someone is stressed about politics, stop. Stop the politics. This is not hard. And it's not as hard, actually, as quitting other things that might be bad for your health, other addictive substances. It's just not. I'll give you an example. Try doing no politics for a weekend. It's pretty easy. Now, if you drink heavily or smoke heavily or do something else unhealthy, physically or mentally healthy, physically or mentally addicting, you can't stop for a weekend. Politics is not of that level. It doesn't have that tug. And if it does, you've got a problem, and it ain't politics. You've got a much bigger problem than that. Arrested Development might be the problem. I would want to know from this audience if they know anyone or they themselves, you yourselves, suffer any anxiety whatsoever over politics. I'm not talking about public policy. I'm talking about what they're talking about, politics. Common problems, according to this article, include sleep disturbances and falling out with family members and friends with divergent views. Social media battles are another source of tension. It is my thesis, folks, that this does not affect conservatives, or at least not anywhere nearly as much as it affects leftists. There are reasons for this. And by the way, I believe my position would obtain and would have been equally true when Barack Obama was president, when our party was not in the White House. If you know differently, let me know. Or if you share my views, let me know. This anxiety over politics business, this is a problem of the left. And the reasons, my thesis, are, as I said, again, immaturity or arrested development and an insufficient understanding of what politics is or can be, or winning and losing. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Todd is in Phoenix. Hi, Todd. How are you, man?
Hey, Seth. Doing well. Yourself?
I am doing just fine. Thank you, sir.
I just got out of work, and so you guys are always on the radio, and so it just comes on. But you were talking about the social media and anxieties and stuff. Believe me, I've been married 40 years. I got 3 daughters. I stress about very, very, very little.
You know the difference between the critical and the frivolous. I love it.
Oh, yeah. But I have lost kind of a family member because of it, politics. He was a big Bernie supporter in 2016. And then when Hillary screwed him over, he just went straight to Hillary's. And I'm like, dude, how can you do that? I mean, that's like someone robbing you and then you go into court and, you know, defending them. That's ridiculous. So, and he's a school teacher. He's 14 years younger than I am, so maybe that's got something to do with it. Different mother, and she's kind of squirrely, too. So I guess that's where that comes in. But
they left you, know, you I'm guessing. You didn't leave them.
Well, I'm in Arizona. They're all back in Georgia. All of
but as far as the relationship ending, you know?
Oh, well, I don't know if it was kind of – I rarely talk to him anyway, but – you know, I had him on Facebook and stuff, and just because of the stupid stuff he was posting, Bernie and stuff, I just unfollowed him. I didn't unfriend him, you know, because he's my brother, but I did unfollow him because I just can't handle stupidity, regardless of who it's from.
Yeah, there's no reason you have to have in your feed things that are stupid. I mean, I follow things on Twitter that make me think or that are of interest to me. I'm not going to follow things that you know, just make no sense.
I had a bunch of celebrities on Twitter, and, you know, it seems like a lot of them are left-wing, and so I just been unfollowing those right and left. You know, I tend to follow people. Kevin Sorbo, he's a very good conservative. I don't know if you've ever listened to his stuff or followed him at all, but he's, you know, he played Hercules.
Right, so, I know who you mean, but no, in my in my limited range of what I follow, I'll take a look if you think it's good. I'm always open to suggestions.
He's a very conservative guy. He does a lot of the Christian movies, you know. He does a lot of that stuff, and I've met him. He's a good guy.
Okay,
so there's a few of them out there.
I like the idea that you have a wife and 3 daughters, and this is not anxiety. Politics does not create anxiety. I like that a lot, Todd. That's a real understanding of what's important, what's not. Hal, Dr. Hal's in Prescott. Hi, Hal.
Hey, Seth. Hey, thank you for taking the call.
Of course. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well. How about yourself?
I'm doing just fine. You have a lot of patients that come to you with anxiety over politics, do you?
No, I'm in the wrong specialty for that.
Okay. You have to refer any to a specialist?
No.
Okay.
Not just yet.
Okay.
Maybe after 2020. We'll see.
Yeah, well, people are a little more normal in Yavapai County, it seems to me.
Yes. Yeah, there is an unusual amount of normal up here. It's one of the
right, but right, which is my thesis. If the politics are, you know, not to the left, I'm guessing, and regardless of whether it's a Republican or Democrat in the White House, if your politics are not left-wing, I just don't think you take it seriously enough to have an anxiety disorder.
You know what? I think that's exactly it.
Yeah.
And it's a good sign that we don't have mass psychosis.
Yeah.
It's limited in scope right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we have is a small minority of people who, they're all the way down their own little rabbit hole in terms of information and very carefully curated facts and information that come to them, and they don't see anything else.
Yeah, when they have all the right on their side as they see it, and they're convinced themselves that there is no other possible point of view that could be legitimate, I can understand why you would have anxiety if someone, deviates. I get that. I do get that. We conservatives are not so closed-minded.
No, it's actually impossible to be it's not impossible to be closed-minded, but much more difficult to be closed-minded because you're inundated. You're carried along in the rapids or the stream of the leftist culture.
That's right.
And it's unavoidable. And you really have to live on a desert island to not be exposed to the leftist perspective.
But there's something else. That is part one. And there's a part two, I think, too, Hal. If you ever go to a conservative conference or a Republican conference, a Republican Party conference or conservative conference, there's a lot more diversity of views on various issues of public policy than, if you go to a Democrat or left-wing policy conference. They all want to make sure they're of just the right exact woken framework. That's not true at a conservative party, a conservative movement or caucus or conference or a Republican Party conference or caucus. It's just not.
Well, yeah, it's because debate and difference and deliberative democracy are part of the conservative way.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you will find a variety of views on social policy, foreign policy. You will. You just will. Even immigration policy, quite frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the difference between having, like a Lenin-like party line
mm-hmm.
where you believe this because it is for the good of the party,
yeah.
period. And you don't need to think about it any further than that.
Yeah. Did you see that video? I mean, a good example of this was this video that got out, 2-3 months ago from the Socialist Conference. I think it was in California or Las Vegas, I don't remember which. And each, the speaker had to keep, changing the rules for the audience, and they all went along with it. You can't clap because it will, it shows some kind of offense to someone. You can't use pronouns. And they all just agree with it as a herd. They all just want to make sure they're of the right, specifically and exquisitely right point of view. They all want to be in that correct woke corner of ideology.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is it continuously evolves.
Yeah.
And there's a great article in the New Criterion recently about Lenin and political correctness. And one of the things that they wrote was that, listen, Stalin was shooting people who were loyal party members, but it's because that they had adhered too firmly to Marxist ideology rather than what exactly the party, according to Stalin, was dictating as to what was the truth at that moment.
Oh, right, right.
And so it's the same problem on the left that they've always had. You can't clap because it disturbs me. You can't do this. You can't do that. Next year, it'll be a completely different set of complaints by a completely different set of people.
No, that's right. It's a constantly shifting goal. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And it'll be like a convention of minds at some point. Not to insult the mind.
No, right? I got you. Now, I have to hit a break, but I know you wanted to weigh in on the movie discussion. Do you want to hold that for the other side of this break real quick?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thank you, Seth.
Yeah, you betcha. I'm Seth Leibson, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Hal, thanks for holding. I gave
sure.
my distillation on the movie The Joker earlier in the show, and you wanted to weigh in as well.
Yeah, yeah. I think what you're describing with The Joker is generally in our society, you have this competition with different types of spectacles for the attention of young people. For
mm-hmm.
example, video games,
sure.
which are increasingly violent.
Sure.
So you kind of have this arms race in terms of trying to get people to watch these things. And it's kind of like a downward spiral in terms of spectacle, the spectacle of violence. And it's just one more example of how our society is kind of degrading. You know, if you read, for example, I mean, just reading Lenin Think. It was called Lenin Think at the New Criterion. I think it was accessible to the public.
Okay.
It was put out in the last couple of months. But the author is a college professor, and he discussed Lenin's, in this article and another one, the rationalization of violence and terror and murder that Lenin made. And it's basically, if it's good for the party to terrorize people, to murder them and torture them, and to have this tremendous violence towards them, it is morally good. And so I think because we don't understand the history within the last 100 years, just simply because people are not educated about it, about the real violence that has happened and the horror that has happened, we're kind of disconnected from, you know, this spectacle and what it really means. And so, you know, and on top of that, you have this kind of hypocrisy on the left in terms of, you know, cinematic violence. You know, when The Passion of the Christ was coming out, there was this frenzy in the media about, oh, how this is going to cause a whole bunch of anti-Semitic violence, you know, and there was nothing. And now they're saying, oh, the Joker is going to cause incel violence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, their concerns about violence are just another manifestation of their ideology. You know, other people are violent and we are not.
Right.
Whereas perhaps it's more important to be aware of the extremes on one's own side and try and temper them and bring them under control. They are focused outward instead of inward. And so I think that, you know, perhaps what we can learn from the Joker and from The Passion of the Christ and these other things is the ideological response that we see from our elites, as opposed to a general concern about, hey, listen, we are systematically desensitizing large numbers of people from violence and what it really means and the history of violence in humanity.
And all the while defining deviancy down, right?
Yes, a downward spiral.
Right. Hal, nicely put. Thank you. I'm going to read as much as I can of this Lenin Think piece on the break. Lenin believed that state power had to be based on sheer terror, and so he created the terrorist state. Good recommendation, sir. Thank you. I appreciate it. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.